generation seems to rebel against the parents' generation. It kind of gets a little bit less of a division between the grandparents and the grandchildren. Have you noticed that? They're not quite as antagonistic toward each other, but it seems like that happens. Sometimes the younger generation rebels against the good things that their parents' generation tried to teach them and tried to live. But sometimes they rebel against the not so good things. So do you remember the striking, I'm going to release the kids about 5 minutes into this because I think they'll enjoy the story of Joshua, a part of it that we're going to look at. But do you remember the striking statement that led to the flood of Noah's time? Every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. And so that's why he chose Noah and started all over again, because Noah was chosen because he alone walked with God. However, Noah was not the exact opposite of every human heart of his time. That is, every inclination of Noah's heart was not only good all the time. In fact, Noah is the first of what I would consider sort of the big heroes of faith in the Old Testament. And there are very few, if any, heroes in the Old Testament who were only good all of the time. And we hear stories of the times that they fell and the times when their work, when their faith was weak. And I can only think of three of those Hebrew heroes that did not have a major stain on their records when we are told about, or that we are told about. Now, I'm sure that the three that I'm thinking of were not perfectly faithful every day of their lives, but they didn't get drunk and pass out naked like Noah, or come up with his own way to have a son instead of trusting God's promises like Abraham, or fail to trust God and strike a rock to bring water instead of speaking to it as he had been instructed like Moses, or commit adultery and murder like David. But the three I'm thinking of who did not have those kinds of failings, or we didn't, you know, we don't hear about them at least, are Joseph and Joshua and Daniel. I'm sure that they all had bad moments, but the only lessons that we are given from these three are what happens when we trust God's promises. There are lesser heroes whose failures we don't see, but these are the only major heroes, in my way of looking at it at least, whose sins are not published for all time. So we're going to focus in on Joshua today. And he was the first of the Israelite leaders that were called judges. He was Moses' aide from his youth, and he led the Israelites in their military battles even before the conquest of the promised land of Canaan. I'm hearing a ring. Is everybody else hearing that?
Yeah.
Mike, could you turn my mic down a little bit? So the first incident that we remember most strikingly happened maybe as soon as a few years after the Israelites were rescued from their slavery to the Egyptians. The law had been given to Moses, and there had been many amazing signs and wonders before they left Egypt, and then while they were in the desert, after they left Egypt, God provided manna and quail to feed them. They had every reason to trust God and no reason to think that God would abandon them. But they tended to be whiners and wimps. So still, God provided for them and protected them, but it wasn't really very long before it was time to go in and take the land that God had promised to Abraham many years before this generation. And so Moses chose one man from each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and he gave them these instructions. He said, "Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country and see what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? They're out in the desert. Okay. So do your best to bring back some of the fruit, excuse me, of the land. Now remember, there were no atlases. There were no encyclopedias, no newspapers, certainly no Google Earth to provide information for them. So they knew nothing about this land that had been promised to Abraham. They had no idea who they would be facing in terms of resistance or whether the land seemed to be worth the challenges that they were going to face. So these 12 explored the land for 40 days and did bring back some of the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here's its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. Okay, that's not the verse that I wanted to read, Ron. Anyway, they came back and they gave this report, but they also brought back some grapes. It was such a huge bunch of grapes that two men had to carry it on a pole between them. Now, notice what, when they went in, Moses did not instruct them to assess. He did not tell them to make a report on whether they could take the land. But this is what happened. Then Caleb, silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are." That night, all the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, "If only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." And then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, were among those who had explored the land. They tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord. And do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." So, because Joshua trusted God's promises, and Moses did not trust in that one instance where he struck the rock instead of speaking to it, we don't know why that was such an grievous thing. Doesn't seem like so bad to us, but it was. So God takes Moses out of the picture, and Joshua leads a whole new generation of Israelites into the promised land. Now that's not to say that Moses ended his life in shame, not at all. But after the faithless 10 spies gave the bad report, the whole community was destined to wander in the wilderness for 40 years until everyone over 20 years old died, except for Joshua and Caleb. And Joshua is the one who was given the role of Moses after he died as leader of the Israelites. The younger generation learned at that time what they should not do from their parents' generation. And they learned what they should do from Joshua and Caleb. So Joshua leads the Israelites in conquest, and this is the summary of what happened 40 years later. So Joshua took the entire land just as the Lord had directed Moses, and he gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal divisions. Okay. Kind of want to sing that song, but I don't know. We won't. Go ahead and take the kids if you want to. All right, so against all odds, God fulfills his promise to give them victories over stronger and much more numerous armies. So, what then? Did Joshua become king and set up a government like we might expect? Well, one of the ironies of the American Revolution was that after George Washington led the Americans, the colonies, out from under the oppression of King George III, this is King George III, many people wanted to make George Washington King George of America. Hmm. Now look at that. This is a portrait. I have the idea that the portraiter knew of this portrait of King George III, put George Washington in exactly the same posture, but notice that instead of George Washington leaning on an ermine, a fur train for his, that was around him like King George, he has his hand on a cannon. So take that, pretty boy. Well, George Washington had the integrity to refuse to be made king. And a much better form of government was developed. And I would say that the ideals of our government were the best of any in the world, even though the people of that time didn't live up to those ideals. Yet because of those ideals, our government is able to attempt to make corrections to evil practices. Things like slavery and oppression of women and minority races and Native Americans. Now, although many of the principles of our government are certainly drawn from the law of Moses and from Christian principles taught by Jesus and his apostles, our government itself is not patterned after any government in the Bible. Think about that for a moment. So, not only was our government not patterned after a biblical government, the truth is that God did not give a pattern for any government at all. At least, not what we would call a government. When the Israelites entered into the promised land, this is what they were given. So, Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses, and he gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal divisions. That meant every family in every tribe got land. So each of the 12 tribes of Israel got their own territory. Each family got their own land to develop and work, except for the Levites, who were assigned to the cities. And so they presumably became the merchants and the educators, but also they were the ones who served in the temples. And the priests came from the Levites. Not all Levites were priests, but all priests were Levites. Now, what was conspicuously absent when they went into this land was a human ruler. There was no king. The closest thing that they had to rulers were called judges. And Joshua was the first leader of Israel that fit that description. Joshua certainly had a lot of power and influence, but it was not because he had a title or a government around him. It was because of his faith in God's sovereignty. And sovereignty is what this is all about. Sovereignty is, in a true monarchy, a human king has sovereign powers. He can make laws and decrees, he can change them, he can order people to be soldiers, he can take wives as he wishes, he can make people slaves, he can take as much money and land as he wants. He can declare war. He can make peace. And that was the highest form of government that was known at the time and aspired to. But God did not give them a human with those kinds of powers. God alone retained those kinds of powers. But even God was not seen exercising those powers in the way that human kings did. Kings always were doing what was best for themselves. God was providing what was best for every member of society. Well, how did he do that? He gave them the law through Moses. We call it the law of Moses, but really it was God's law, and Moses was the instrument through whom God communicated that law. But what about enforcement of the law? Well, in the wilderness, we saw various ways that God enforced the law. You know, people were disciplined. Some of them were very harsh. But in the promised land, the only enforcement that we have record of was through leaders that they called judges. As I said, Joshua was the first of the judges, and during Joshua's life, things went very well. Not only did God reward his faithfulness and entrust the conquest to him, the people saw his faithfulness. They saw his integrity. They saw his courage. And they followed him and followed his example willingly. But once they were no longer fighting wars, all they really needed to do was obey the law that they had. Who needs enforcement? So when Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment, what did he say? Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Here's the key. All the law and the prophets were teaching, telling people to come back to God. All of the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So all of the specific situations that you read about, they're spelled out in the law of Moses, are really only the enforcement of those two commandments. But even if those two were all we had and we didn't have all of the rest of the law of Moses, even if they didn't have all of the law of Moses, they wouldn't need any enforcers as long as they lived by those principles. If you love God, then you won't follow false gods who supposedly tell you to do evil things. You won't adopt human philosophies that result in harmful practices. And if for some reason it is not clear who should get something that you and your neighbor both want, then you'll both be trying to give it to the other person rather than trying to get it for yourself, because that's love. So who needs a government? If we follow that law, who needs a government? We only need an earthly government if and when someone refuses to live by those two laws. But even if a number of people refuse to live by those laws, I think we could have a great society even if most people did. The ones who live by love would be able to absorb the problems caused by those who did not, you know, up to a certain point. So we still shouldn't need a government with police and armies and taxes and a bunch of laws that make it difficult for everybody. So when is the line crossed that causes us to cry out for a government? That is what the book of Judges is all about. It boils down to what John said in the last line of 1 John, idolatry, keep yourselves from idols. The worship of any kind of idols will always lead to suffering and disorder. Let's look at what Joshua said before he died and what happened after he died. After a long time had passed, and the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them, Joshua, by then old and well advanced in years, summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to them, I am old and well advanced in years. You yourselves have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was the Lord your God who fought for you. Be very strong. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or to the left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them. But you are to hold fast to the Lord your God as you have until now. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000, because the Lord your God fights for you, just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. Now, note that. You know, things had gone well because they didn't follow their parents' example, and they did follow Joshua's example and Caleb's example. So, from this point on, how did they do? Well, here's how it started, you know, as we continue into the book of Judges. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. So things went pretty well for a while. But then, after that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. And from that point, a pattern developed. God would allow others to oppress the Israelites as punishment until they would finally cry out to God for relief. And then what? Well, there was no central government, but God gave them judges to settle disputes and to lead them back to worshiping God. But they were also basically the only ones who were kind of able to muster an army, to call an army together, to lead the Israelites into battle against their oppressors. They would be successful as long as they followed the judges, but it never lasted. Mm-hmm. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshiped them. They quickly turned from the ways of their ancestors who had been obedient to the Lord's command. The book of Judges is really kind of an R-rated book that some think was intended to provide a valid reason for Israel to ask for a king. The first time it says it is not until we get to chapter 17, but then it's repeated. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And then again, in those days, Israel had no king. And then again, in those days, Israel had no king. And then in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, we cannot actually know the mindset of the writers of our scriptures. We really don't. You know, some say God told them what to write. Well, God approved what they wrote is probably a better way of putting it. They are inspired by the Holy Spirit for our benefit. And if we use those writings properly, then we can benefit from the lessons and the teachings in all of them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the writers had a perfect understanding of God's will in every case. Paul even says so in one of his letters. He says, I think I have the Spirit on this. So maybe the writer of Judges really thought that the horrible behavior of the people in the time of the judges was so bad that kings were a better idea than what God had given them. But regardless of what the writer who wrote those words thought, when Israel did have kings, we will see that they did not eliminate the problems that they had during the time of the judges. And personally, I believe that the writer was not defending the call for a king. I think he was just explaining it. But we will look at the real result of what happened in the time of the judges over the next several weeks and what God says about their desire for a king when we get to the last of the judges in 1 Samuel. For today, let's ask some questions that we might need to come to terms with. First of all, why do we follow other gods? We talked about this last week. Well, one thing that happens, one of the mechanical things that happen is that we simply stop listening to previous generations. After that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Now, do you think that the previous generation just kept all of their experience and beliefs to themselves? You know, and never told their kids and grandkids what God had done and what they had learned from the bad example of their parents and who they should and should not worship. Not possible. You know, like Bob Stromberg's dad, you know, they're always telling us, you know, how it was when they were young. The truth was, it wasn't because they didn't hear it. It was because they just didn't listen. They didn't believe. They had to have blocked it out. And probably they used some kind of clever logic, you know, to say why they shouldn't believe that and why they should follow another path. So that's why they didn't know the Lord or what he had done for Israel. We should never stop listening to the lessons of the older generation. Now, not all of those lessons of previous generations are found in their words or beliefs. Some of the lessons are found in the tragedies of their beliefs and their actions. Now, if we are looking to the words of the previous generation, we should only listen to the words of those who humbled themselves. So we can learn from both the failures and the successes of previous generations. But we need to listen only to those who know the difference when we're talking about words. So how do we avoid reliving the failures of previous generations, and how do we instead relive the glories of previous generations? Let's focus on two things that Joshua said to them before he died. But you are to hold fast to the Lord your God, as you have until now. In our fast-moving news cycle, it doesn't seem like it's only been 3 months since the floods in Central Texas. And it gave us pictures like this and like this. And then it gave us stories about survivors like Addison Martin. This is her story as told in a news report. As the water rose, her family decided to climb a tree that sat between a camping spot that hung over an adjacent trailer. They were camping. To climb onto the trailer, Addison and several families stood on top. And then it started to shift. She saw her stepmother fall and tried to pull her up. And she heard someone yelling for air. Soon she was in the water, fighting currents and limbs that briefly held her under. Her family members drifted out of sight. I remember just thinking, I don't want to die, she said. She finally grabbed onto a branch and held on for my life for hours. Trees were falling into the water. She asked God to keep her tree up. I've never prayed so much in my life. Mm-hmm. Daylight finally broke, the tree still standing. By roughly 8 a.m., she yelled to first responders who came with a boat, and she and her brother were reunited at a rescue center. The rest of their family did not survive. Mm-hmm. So Joshua's instruction is to cling to God. Hold on for dear life. Holding fast to the Lord is about those we hold on to, holding fast to the Lord is about who we hold on to when we need to be rescued from whatever threatens us in life. Most of the time, it will not be a physical threat, but an emotional threat like the death of someone in our family, or a spiritual threat like a temptation to do something that we know is harmful to ourselves or to others or both. We can look to all kinds of things that will only make matters worse when we're threatened. We can hang on to all kinds of other things. Even though they may provide some temporary relief or escape, it's not going to last for long. Alcohol and other drugs are what we might think of first, but there are all kinds of other gods that we can give our lives to. And some of them may seem like they're even good things, like immersing yourself in work. That's one way, you know, something to hang on to when you're emotionally disturbed. But anything that we cling to and we give our lives to that is not under the umbrella of our faith in God is an idol. And we will ultimately lose our life if that's all we're hanging on to. If we cannot see God in something and thank him for it, then it's an idol. Can you thank God for an addiction? Can you thank God for an affair? Can you thank God for a job or anything that keeps you away from your family and your church family? Can you thank God for times that you use your abilities to raise yourself up by stepping on others? You know, don't say God is blessing me in those situations. Now, there are things and people and techniques that even people who are not worshipers of God, of the one true God, may also use that can be helpful when we're desperate. Some counselors who are not even followers of Jesus can help a follower. If you can get a Christian counselor, I highly recommend that. That's a much better way to go, but doesn't mean not all counselors don't have good advice, good techniques. Sometimes a prescription drug or a nutritional supplement can help a follower of Jesus and can help a non-follower of Jesus too. Sometimes meditation or exercise or some technique can help a follower of Jesus. In fact, some of those things can help an unbeliever just as much. But we can still thank God for them if we are faithful. The fact that something helps both a believer and an unbeliever does not make it an idol. If we thank God for it, then it is under the umbrella of our faith in God. It's only when we give the glory and the gratitude to someone or something other than God first that it becomes an idol. In other words, don't say or even think, for example, therapy saved me, unless you thank God for the therapy. Now, we can actually cling to God without doing the other thing that Joshua told them to do. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. So we must not look to God only when we're hanging on to a tree limb or trying to survive a grief or a sickness or a loss or some fear. We must actually love him, not just look to him, you know, when we're in distress. So we need to love God. Think about this in the context of romantic love. There are some people who can get fixated on another person and try to always be with them and do everything they do and be everywhere they are. You know, do we call them lovers? No, we call them stalkers. Very few people are not really turned off by clingy people. Clingy people may need our love, but they may need us to love them enough to encourage them to, you know, get some help. But that's not really my point. My point is that we can't just cling to God. We've got to love him. How do we do that? Well, don't forget what John told us to do. Love is more than a feeling. It is a decision. It is an action. We can express love for God in words and songs and beliefs, like we're doing here. Believing that Jesus is God's Son and that he did come in the flesh and that he was raised from the dead is a part of our love for God. But it's more than that. Our love for God is more than that. Our love for God is tested when we have difficult or challenging people in our lives. As John put it, if we say that we love God but we hate our brothers and sisters, we are liars. It's good that some people can have these, you know, sort of transcendent feelings at times about God. But, you know, not having those kinds of feelings does not mean that we do not love God. And having them does not mean that we do love God. It's when we love our neighbors as ourselves and we give God the glory for what we are able to do for them, that's when we know that we love God. Let's pray. Our Father, we are so thankful for